This is PS-108, Emergency Airway Management 2018. Our emergency tracheostomy is obsolete. Thank you all for being here. We have an expert panel who will educate us today. And then at the end, I anticipate having some time for questions from the audience. We have one and possibly two and a little bit microphone set up. So when we get to that portion, we'll ask you to come up if you have any questions. So I'm just curious, by show of hands, in your entire career, how many of you have ever done an emergency tracheostomy? So the majority of people in the room. Now, again, by show of hands, how many of you have done one in the last 2 or 3 years? So still a fair percentage. All right, well, we'll see what we learn from the session today. Our first speaker is going to talk on emergency tracheostomies, history, techniques, and complications. And that'll be Dr. Richard Fortuna, who's from Washington University in St. Louis, assistant professor of surgery, vascular surgery, and trauma. And he's director for the Center for Sustainment of Trauma and Readiness, or CSTAR. You start, I just want to take this moment too to thank all of our panel for educating us today. They devote both their expertise and their time to be here, so thank you all very much for being here and doing that.
Well, first off, I'd just like to thank the college for the opportunity to share some of these thoughts and views with you here today, and glad everybody was able to make it. Standard disclosure slide, first off, since I am active duty military, the views that I'm going to present to you today do not reflect those of the federal government or the United States Air Force, and I have no relevant financial conflicts of interest for this topic. So a little bit of history on tracheostomy. It's one of the oldest reported surgical procedures. There are depictions all the way back on Egyptian tablets dating back to 3600 BC, which is pretty astonishing, I thought, when kind of researching this. The Greeks also have documentation of tracheostomies back to 2nd and 3rd century AD. And there's even some kind of folklore stories about Alexander the Great performing a tracheostomy on a choking soldier at a victory banquet with his sword while he was choking on some food. There's reports within the medieval Islamic history. And then the first scientifically reliable descriptions of successful tracheostomy really were presented by Dr. Brazzavola in 1546 when he was doing these to relieve airway obstruction for enlarged tonsils. This is kind of an interesting point. From 1546 to 1833, there were only 28 successful tracheostomies recorded in the medical literature. And I would say when you compare that today to where we're doing 800,000 to a million tracheostomies a year, somewhere in that neighborhood. Not all of those emergencies, of course. In 1799, George Washington died of an upper airway obstruction or abscess. Washington's physician was familiar with the procedure, but he'd never actually done one. And this is his family practice doc. If you are familiar with some of the history surrounding George Washington, he actually had 3 or 4 physicians that were called upon to take care of him on his deathbed. And most of what they did was leech him or bleed him, which certainly did not help him recover. He was reportedly unwilling to do his first tracheostomy, though, on a person of Washington's stature. I would suggest not be surprised in today's political environment that would probably not be the case today. The early 20th century saw tracheostomy become safer as technical aspects were refined by famous doctors such as Dr. Jackson. And you can see there at the bottom of the screen how the materials had become more progressive, and you see these stainless steel Jackson tracheostomy tubes. Tracheostomy really took off during the polio epidemic, and then in present day, tracheostomy is more commonly used for prolonged mechanical ventilation than for upper airway obstruction, such as what George Washington died of. Here are some indications Now, these are by no means meant to be all-inclusive. You know, certainly these are the most common, and obviously any of these can be translated over into emergency settings, but normally these days we're performing tracheostomies for prolonged intubation, both acute and chronic respiratory failure, to improve vent support and vent weaning, to improve pulmonary hygiene and manage secretions, for upper airway obstruction, the inability to intubate, which is becoming rarer, I think, as adjuncts have advanced. As an adjunct for the management of severe trauma and major head and neck surgery, and then for airway protection during our management of severe TBI and neurologic patients. So this is kind of a little bit of a linear history of the techniques that have been advanced over standard tracheostomy procedures, and you can see kind of in the mid-80s we started to take off with these sequential dilators and then kind of progress to kind of a Griggs technique of dilating forceps, retrograde assistance, single step dilators, a dilating screw, and then balloon facilitated. Obviously, open has been a mainstay for quite some time, and I'm sure everyone in this room is familiar with the different ways to do this, and whether or not you're a horizontal or vertical, or you're tacking up your tracheostomy flap. From a percutaneous standpoint, all of these procedures that I'll kind of go over with you to set the stage for the other speakers really come through a basic access using a Seldinger technique, if you want to look at it that way, to gain access to the airway with a needle and then the passage of a wire. The sequential dilators are just that, and you can see here a picture taken, and I'm going to unabashedly say all of these just came off a Google search, so you don't see a citation on this. The dilating forceps are what is maybe commonly known as a Griggs technique, and you see a Griggs kit and some pictures here, and basically you're just dilating traditionally with some sort of hemostat or tracheotomy spreader. Fanconi technique, or a retrograde approach where the wire is actually passed from the trachea through the mouth, and then you perform your intubation that way. Single step dilators. I think this is what I'm probably most familiar with and have used the most. This is the this particular product is a Blue Rhino. You can use it with serial dilators that you see there in the kit, but pretty standard and I think ubiquitous out there in most institutions. The dilating screw, I have to admit that this is one that I had not seen or was aware of when I was putting this slide talk together, and you know, quite frankly, I think this would be a little scary on my end and just looks like a torture device. And then this is a balloon facilitated, and you can see there in the middle picture the kind of second balloon, if you will, dilating the proposed tracheotomy tract. This is known as a Blue Dolphin. I've never seen this product. So a little bit of information about open versus percutaneous techniques. This is controversial. It's why we're having the panel, and I think it's going to be interesting to hear what the other speakers have to say. If you just strictly go off available literature right now, in the elective settings, it's been suggested that percutaneous tracheostomy should be the procedure of choice. This comes from two large reviews and meta-analysis, and these both have over 15 randomized controlled trials and over 1,000 patients in each. And what the data would suggest is that percutaneous tracheostomy was associated with reduced wound infections. There was no difference in bleeding or major procedural complications with either technique. There's no difference in scarring or subglottic stenosis or false passages. The percutaneous group had shorter case times and reduced cost, but there was an increased rate of decannulation and obstruction with percutaneous techniques. When so kind of overall suggestion is there's really no difference, and it's a little bit of dealer choice, and we'll see if that's presented differently with our other panelists. As far as the individual percutaneous techniques go, they're essentially equivalent. They have similar complication rates, and they're all highly successful when performed correctly, of course. The exception is for retrograde technique, which is associated with higher complication rates. So here again are some indications and contraindications for percutaneous dilation tracheostomy. Indications, and again, I use these kind of loosely because I'm certain there are people in the room that look at these as relative in both of the categories, and we've probably all done these in certain situations where things are necessitated. The ability to extend the neck, favorable anatomy, which I think is used very loosely, at least from my perspective, and then the ability to tolerate transient hypercarbia and hypoxemia. Contraindications would be emergency airway access. I put that on there, and it's why we're here. I think for a lot of us, and you'll see at least on the military, that for tactical casualty care requirements, it's still the obtaining a surgical airway, and they don't delineate open versus percutaneous, but I think most folks would go with an open technique. Morbid obesity and short neck, C-spine injury. The aberrant blood vessels, I think, are very important and often underappreciated in the number of procedures that we do on this. And, you know, frequently we hear about this part getting missed and leading to a very poor outcome. I think with how ubiquitous ultrasound is in all of our emergency departments and ICUs now, we're really starting to see some trends and some evidence in the literature that putting an ultrasound probe on the neck before you start these procedures either way is probably a prudent maneuver. Thyroid and trachea pathology, coagulopathy, thrombocytopenia, gas exchange problems. Some literature gives actual numbers on here. I left this a little loose just with excessive PEEP and FiO2 because I'm sure that probably varies within your own institutions and ICUs as to when it's acceptable to try to perform a percutaneous procedure. And then neck and soft tissue infections. Complications can really be divided into three phases, if you will, immediate, early, and late. On the immediate side, you see hemorrhage, injury to the trachea, procedure failure, aspiration, air embolism, loss of airway, hypoxemia, hypercarbia, and certainly death. Early, you have a risk still for hemorrhage, tube displacement, pneumothorax and pneumomediastinum from the passage in the creation of the passage for the tracheotomy, subcutaneous emphysema, stomal infections and ulcerations, accidental decannulation and dysphagia. And then late complications of tracheal stenosis, granulation tissue, tracheomalacia, pneumonia, aspiration events, tracheoarterial fistula, tracheoesophageal fistulas, accidental decannulation and dysphagia. And I would point out that these are not necessarily specific to either percutaneous or open. So I just wanted to present a little bit of data from the pre-hospital setting out of our military stuff. This is the only information I'll give you that kind of sides, but I couldn't help but kind of throw this in with my background, and also that it's pretty fresh off the press, if you will, with this being an EPUB ahead of actual print. So this is information out of San Antonio and one of my former classmates at the Academy, Dr. Babarda. But it's a retrospective review of our medevac U.S. military personnel injured in Operation Enduring Freedom from January 2011 to March of 2014. And really they were trying to target the patients who had received any kind of airway intervention prior to military treatment facility arrival. So they reviewed a little over 1,200 patients and had over 600 airway interventions. You can see the breakout there. What I thought was kind of interesting on this is even in an emergency pre-hospital setting, the amount of airways that were managed with just nasal and oral airways. You can see the groups are pretty evenly matched, though, when it comes to valve mask ventilation and surgical cricothyroidotomy, which, as I told you, is the standard of care in our tactical combat casualty care setting. So important points there is patients with cricothyroidotomy or bag valve mass had greater ventilator, hospital, and ICU free days as compared to supraglottic airway. I'll tell you a little bit of why I think that is. And you know, normally these patients, I think, that are getting supraglottic airways are not completely sedated. and they're being performed for other reasons, and it's generating a gag reflex that then causes folks to vomit, aspirate, and then have more post-airway issues down the road. Difficult to tease that completely out from the manuscript. But it was important that there was no difference in survival with bag valve mask ventilation or with surgical airways, with the survival rate of being about 43%. And if you compare that to some of the civilian data that's out there, it's comparable to about a 50% survival mortality rate with those emergency airways in pre-hospital settings. And with that, I'll wrap up and we'll pass it on to the Dr. Freeman, I think, to talk about percutaneous advantages.